Thank you for joining us today for a message from the Word of God. What follows is a recording from one of our live services at Gooch Lane Church of Christ in Huntsville, Alabama. If you're ever in the area, we'd love to have you join us in person. And if you like what you hear today, you can visit us online at teachingtruth.org, where we have videos, weekly articles on biblical topics, information about our services, and more.
First of all, thank you for coming back. Occasionally I have these bad dreams and we have breaks that we have a break and then I get up and no one's there. So thank you for coming back for part two. I want to begin by just asking, does anybody have any questions or thoughts about our introduction to the Love Bank and how to keep love alive? Yes, sir.
One thing, I really like these books and I like the concepts. It helped me for years and years. I wonder, you know, people always say you need to work at your marriage. And I always came back to it, what does that mean? And
yes.
That helps define what it means. But I think one of the things, one of the glaring omissions from that whole series is that the Love Bank all by itself is naturally a completely self-centered. It's got too much self-centeredness to it. And here's what I mean by that. So I'm not a fan at all of Ruth Bader Ginsburg. But she said something really at one time where she said, you know, sometimes in marriage it helps to be a little hard of hearing. And what she meant by that is perhaps we shouldn't be such big babies in our marriage as to identify and to hold on to every little love buster our spouse happens to participate in, right? Sometimes you just have to get over yourself.
Yeah.
So
give each other grace. Okay. Yeah, give each other grace. That's for sure. All right. Anybody else? One of the key things I wanted to focus in on is when people are really frustrated and thinking about maybe getting divorced and that kind of thing, and you're there hearing this, usually it's because they've given up hope. And if you give them a paradigm that they can use to help really improve things significantly, they regain hope. And they may consider not going through with it. And so I've just found that really helpful. Yes?
Yeah, I was sort of connecting it when you were talking about it to the love languages. And you sort of referenced that when you talked about jails being acts of service.
Yes.
Becky's happens to be the same thing. So she's only happy if I'm mowing the grass.
Or doing the dishes or offering to vacuum for her.
Yeah, that's right. So I got a Roomba, so I can do that.
Yeah.
You know, I think that's one way to think about that love bank is you're sort of trying to understand your spouse and how they receive love.
Yes.
More than how you give it. So there is that sort of selfless act, I think, embedded in that. In that sense, you are trying to be attuned to their reception of it more so than how you would receive it yourself.
Correct.
You're trying to give it in their language.
Yeah. We're going to talk about that more in detail, actually, in session three. So good thoughts. And that's absolutely right. And remember, think about how can I use this to help others? Because it's just so powerful. And I've seen it happen over and over again. We just were talking earlier about the eight elements of this beautiful collage of love that Paul describes for us. It's not uncommon for someone to come in and say, we just don't love each other anymore, so what's the point? And one guy was telling me one time, he said, I just don't love my wife anymore. And I said, well, this is what I want you to do. I want you to go home, and I want you to love her. And he said, Brother Hunter, did you not hear me? I don't love her anymore. I said, what you're telling me is you don't have the feelings for her that you used to. But you can take 1 Corinthians 13, you can memorize it, you can lay up these principles of love and treat her in loving and kind ways because it's the right thing to do. And you know what will happen? She will likely respond in kind, and the feelings follow the action. See, we live in a culture where, well, if I don't feel it, then I'm not going to do it. And we act like, you know, that's some sort of badge of honor. Like, that's something that you ought to, you know, really brag about. Like, well, at least I'm genuine. And sometimes I talk to couples about treating each other kindly, even when you don't feel kindly toward them. And they'll say, I'm not a hypocrite. I'm not doing that. And I just look at them and I say, that is such a wrong-headed thought and way to look at this. If you're a jogger and you get up and jog in the morning, and you do it sometimes even when you're tired, but you do it anyway because it's the right thing to do, are you a hypocrite for jogging when you first started? You didn't want to, but you did it anyway. There's a lot of times I don't really want to brush my teeth, frankly, but I do it anyway because it's the right thing to do, and I value my teeth, and I don't want bad breath. Am I a hypocrite when I'm brushing my teeth when I'd rather be doing something else? Of course not. This is a part of having a good character. And a good character in Christ is doing the right thing, even at times when you don't feel like it. You just overcome that. You move your spirit instead of always being some weakling that just goes based upon how you're feeling at the moment. That's why those vows being on the front burner will help you to treat your spouse in the way you promised, even at times when you're not feeling it. That's not hypocrisy. If I'm kind to an enemy, I'll tell you, the Bible says pray for your enemies. That doesn't come naturally to me. I'm sorry, it doesn't. But then when I think about the situation and I say, well, Jesus told me as his disciple, I need to pray for this person. I pray for them anyway, and I feel better. And my relationship improves. Because you can't hold bitterness and blessing in the same heart toward the same person at the same time. You can't. So a lot of times in our discipleship, we do the right thing even though we're not feeling it. I mean, temptation is drawing you away, but when you recognize it's drawing you away, you don't do what you want to do at the moment. You do the right thing. It's called character. So be charactered and go home and be a man and love your wife and keep your vows. And you come back next week and let's see how that worked for you. And it's amazing how things improve. So kind of keep that in mind when you deal with these kind of relationships. Now, let's talk about these love busters. This is where you protect your marriage by replacing love busting patterns with love building habits. There's that word habit again. So important. So, how do you define a love buster? Is it a destructive marital habit, which is a repeated behavior? A love buster is not something that you do that is just occasional. Everybody's going to occasionally mess up, disappoint, frustrate, irritate. Welcome to the human race, right? A love buster, by definition, is not just occasionally messing up. It's a repeated behavior that causes the other party to be unhappy, make withdrawals from the love bank, and it's something that happens frequently so that the other party kind of dreads it coming up next. I mean, if someone's a drunk and they come home on weekends drunk and they tend to be a mad drunk and maybe be very physically abusive and yell and hard to deal with, and you do that every weekend, you're going to dread the weekends. And you're going to start wanting to avoid this person because they periodically and regularly hurt you and make withdrawals from the love bank. And so that's why one of the major causes of divorce is basically substance abuse. And for obvious reasons, you're constantly making these love busters. And what you want to do is avoid love busters, and that's what you focus in on first. See, this is what happens. You have these times where you've been hurt and offended. There hasn't been appropriate forgiveness and acknowledgement of the offense and asking for forgiveness. Sunday morning, I'm going to be talking about the blessing and power of forgiveness because you can't have a good marriage unless you have two good forgivers. Because if you hold on to hurts and resentments, you become bitter and it creates this wall between the two of you. And when you have a wall between the two of you, it doesn't even allow deposits in. So if you've been really mean to your spouse or thoughtless in some way, and the person is kind of fuming and, you know, thinking about this, and then you go, oh, things aren't going well between us, I'll bring her flowers. She doesn't want flowers when she's mad at you and is afraid that you're going to hurt her in the future. And you haven't acknowledged the hurt you had a few hours ago. Flowers is not going to help. Might even make her mad. So the first thing you got to do is stop the love busters and go through a process of forgiveness so you can get rid of the walls and the strongholds of Satan, the bitterness that have, you know, grown up inside a person's heart, so you can start with a clean slate and then be open to deposits. I mean, think about it as a bucket. You know, you want this bucket full so that you feel emotionally really good toward the other person. If you're putting water in the bucket, but there's a big hole in the bottom, you're kind of, you know, not making a lot of progress. So the first thing you need to do is plug the holes. Stop making withdrawals. Now you can start putting the hose in the bucket and it will fill up quickly. Okay? So that's really, really important. That's what you have to deal with first. And the first very common love buster I want to talk about is angry outburst. I mean, who wants to live with a volcano, right? Somebody that gets, you know, easily kind of their fuse is lit and they say things that in anger that are hurtful. Angry outbursts are used as a way to punish or to get back at the other party. And the danger here is that they're usually said in harshness and they create disrespect. Now, I'm not saying there are not times when you can have a firm tone, or you might even raise your voice somewhat to make a point, but yelling at the other party is something different altogether. And it's just really important to decide you're just not going to yell at your kids and you're not going to yell at each other because it's degrading. My wife gave me permission to tell you that she grew up in a family of yellers. And her parents yelled at her all the time. And she thought when you got into a conflict, that's kind of what you do. You just kind of do what's familiar. Well, I was raised in a home where we didn't yell at each other. In fact, I was told, you don't do that. So our first kind of quarrel after marriage, when my wife starts yelling at me, what's going on here? That's the B-side, folks. And, you know, I made it very clear. Listen, I'm not going to yell at you, and you're supposed to be submissive to me, and here you are yelling at me in this way? This has got to stop. And it took my wife quite a while to get over the bad habit of yelling. And people who know Gail can't hardly imagine her yelling. But in our early marriage, she did. But she's developed a habit now where our kids, they grew up in a home where there wasn't yelling. But she had to identify that. I had to communicate it, and she had to work on it. And that's true in almost every marriage. There are things that you grew up with, maybe, that you think are normal, that are not healthy or functional or loving. And that's the kind of things that need to stop. And one of the primary reasons why couples get divorced and why they're unhappy is not always just the woman or the man, but both parties at times have trouble with angry outburst. I think a good Bible example to me is Job and his wife. I mean, poor Job, he loses his children, loses his friends, loses his treasure. And just when he needs support from his wife, he's losing his health. And instead of giving Job support, you know, you got to give Job's wife a little bit of grace, because these are mostly losses for her as well, right? So I can understand why she's, you know, devastated herself. But he says, you know, the wife says to him, curse God and die. Wow. I doubt that was said in a real normal, calm tone of voice. I mean, she's obviously just at the height of frustration and hurt and just is giving up. And at the moment her husband needed support, she says, just give up, curse God and die. And in spite of that, Job still maintained his integrity. But I imagine at the moment, that was quite a withdrawal from the love bank. When you're going through difficulties, that's the time to rely on each other and pull together, not the time to do the opposite. That's why the Bible says, be swift to hear, slow to speak, and what? Slow to wrath or slow to anger. He was quick-tempered, acts foolishly. How many times have people gotten angry and they've said things they regret? And you can take it back, but it's hard for the person to forget that thing that you said. And it kind of can go deep down to the core of who you are. In the Proverbs, it says, there is one who speaks like the piercing of a soul, but the tongue of the wise promotes healing. So choose your words carefully, for later you may have to eat them, right? Most of the time, this is just a bad habit. And just decide, if you're angry, it's not the time to be maintaining a discussion. Calm down. If you argue when you're angry, you're apt to just make matters worse. So nobody likes to be yelled at, and nobody likes a sudden quick barb said out of anger. And so that's just a habit you have to decide you are going to break. And I recommend that a couple pray about that and help each other to overcome angry outburst. The second love buster, very common, is what Harley refers to as disrespectful judgments. And, it's just, no one likes a caustic critic. John Lund, in his classic book, How to Avoid Physical Divorce by Avoiding Emotional Divorce, he says, when your spouse stops becoming your biggest cheerleader and becomes your biggest critic, the bloom is off the rose. And that's when you start avoiding the person because you're just going to be picked at or criticized. And so that's one of the things that creates emotional divorce. Respectful persuasion is healthy. Don't just shut down and not say anything. Talk it through, but do so respectfully and don't be hypercritical. Disrespectful judgment is when you impose your values on the other person in a way that's a put down. If you had any taste, you'd realize that tie doesn't match or that tie looks terrible. Well, maybe it does. But is there a nicer way you could have said that? Without putting the person's taste down about virtually everything? How about, honey, why don't you try this tie? I think this one might look better. That's not a withdrawal. It's just a suggestion. But people often will go for the juggler. If you were normal, you'd understand why you ought to squeeze the toothpaste from the bottom and not the middle. You know, those tremendous trifles sometimes about those kind of behaviors can really get underneath the other party's skin. Or how about this one? If it wasn't for your mother and your family, you wouldn't feel that way and have the hang-ups that you do. Ooh, those are fighting words. I mean, when you start putting down the other person's mother. And it may be a true statement, but that's not something you say to someone that you supposedly love and you want to have this cooperative conversation with. There are nicer ways to say those things. Be careful not to impose your values. James 4, verses 11 and 12. Do not speak evil of one another. There is one who is the lawgiver and who is able to destroy. Who are you to judge another? And so we're not saying you don't make judgments. Jesus said judge righteous judgments. But we're talking about impugning another person's motives or forcing your opinion on others. 1 Corinthians 13:5 says love does not insist on its own way, right? I think one of the best examples in our society of a disrespectful judgment is how some people use race as a weapon. And if you disagree with somebody about something, oftentimes in our culture, people don't discuss differences in a civil manner, which is really unfortunate. But they'll say, well, you just think that because you're a racist. Well, how do you know my heart? That's one of the most awful things you can accuse somebody of being. And so oftentimes, it's a disrespectful judgment. And in most cases, I think it's probably not true. They keep on redefining what's racist and what's not. And after a while, if everything's racist, then the real racists get away with being it, because after a while, it doesn't mean anything. So be careful about those kind of comments, so common in our culture today, that is so divisive. So you want respectful persuasion and respectful discussions. The third love buster is annoying behaviors. I think of Proverbs 27 and verse 14. If someone blesses his friend with a loud voice early in the morning, it will be taken as a curse. One of the translations says it's like smoke in the eyes. You know, if you're not a morning person and you happen to be married to a morning person, have you ever noticed that morning people always put down night owls? I mean, it's just, why does it have to be that way? It's not a matter of somebody's character. Oftentimes it's a part of somebody's circadian rhythm. But, you know, annoying behaviors. Solomon says, don't do that. If somebody's trying to sleep and they're not ready to get up, don't come in. You know, roll that beautiful bean. Good morning. It's a wonderful day. You know, that kind of thing. So, annoying behaviors. And here's a picture of someone comes in with a loud voice. And you see that person's not very happy. See, it's withdrawal from the love bank. I like this. It says, do I look like I do mornings? No, you don't. You don't look like you do mornings. So be careful until at least 10 to have meaningful discussions with that person. It's the idea of doing something that irritates the other party consistently. And this I find fascinating. Women tend to find men more annoying than men find women. Almost always, the women complain about the annoying behaviors, and the men rarely do. Now, it's rather fascinating to me that in discussions over the years about this, that I ask, why do you think that is? Because this is just a statistical fact when you compare the surveys. And one woman raised her hand and said, well, that's easy. It's just because men are more annoying. And the men tend to say, no, no, no. That's because we're just much more tolerant and not easily offended. I'm not going to even comment on those responses, but I just want to point out that if you're involved in something that your spouse finds annoying, it's not worth the withdrawals from the love bank. So just decide that you're going to come up with a determination to change your habits so you don't annoy your spouse. One woman complained that her husband frequently fell asleep on the couch, and she'd come in and he'd be there snoring with his mouth wide open. And she goes, that's not a very good look. And her husband said, you mean I'm just taking a nap on the couch and I'm making withdrawals from the love bank because my mouth's open and I snore? And I go, yes, that's exactly what I'm saying. And so try to sleep upstairs and avoid, you know, get a mouthpiece. I don't know, but it's easier for you to change your habits than it is for the other person not to be annoyed by whatever it might be. When we were first married, I grew up in a family where if you're done with a section of a book or a magazine, you kind of dog-ear the page of the book so you can find where you left off next time. And my wife came from a family where you never do that. She thought that was kind of rude. You use bookmarks. And so she would say, I saw you were reading my magazines again, and you ruined them. How did I ruin your magazines? Well, look at this. And, you know, they're little, small, little dog-eared pages. I go, that didn't ruin your magazine. And she goes, well, I don't like it. Quit doing it. Okay. So I kept doing it. Not because I intended to, but because it's just a lifelong habit. I just wasn't thinking. I guess that's the problem sometimes. We're not thinking. See, I was consciously incompetent in that regard. And then I became, I was unconsciously incompetent. Then I became consciously incompetent. And finally, I got over that. And now I would never dog-ear a magazine. I developed a new habit. And I didn't want to annoy my wife, so it finally enabled me to change that annoying behavior. And that's really what you need to do, especially when you first get married. You know, if you're always late and your spouse wants to be on time, that can be very annoying. You know, if you have poor posture, always tapping your fingers in a way that, you know, bothers your spouse or kind of gets on her nerves. Women primping before the mirror all the time and taking forever to get finished. That can be annoying to the husband. And so you guys are laughing at these things, but they matter as far as the love bank is concerned, and that's how you feel about one another. So talk about annoying behaviors and make a commitment to be considerate, because that's really what this is. Then there's selfish demands. You know, demands choke out love. You can have a slave or a lover, but you can't have both. And remember, love does not insist on its own way, right? Love doesn't offer selfish demands. Threats, lectures, and manipulation build resentment and causes the other party discomfort. You need to make sure when you talk to one another that it's an adult to an adult, not kind of an adult to a child. And sometimes women will kind of view their husbands like one of the kids. That's not good. Or the husband will kind of be fatherly toward the spouse. That's not good. You're spiritually equal, and you're in a cooperative partnership. And be careful that you don't in any way look like you're demeaning the other party. And avoid selfish demands, making decisions that you know the other party is not going to like, and just, well, I'm going to do this anyway. Commanding your spouse to do things that benefits you at the spouse's expense will multiply the threat of punishment and implied threat of punishment if you refuse. That's really deadly to a marriage. Don't ever use money or sex as a weapon. No. Well, you know, I'll provide for your sexual needs, but only if you do A, B, and C that I want you to do. Or I'm not going to give you the money that you want unless you do A, B, and C. That is not a cooperative enterprise. It is using these things that ought to be just a given in a marriage in a way to manipulate the other party. No wonder after a while somebody says, I don't want to be with this person anymore. We're here to work together, not manipulate each other. And that kind of thing causes a lot of resentment. Delilah pressuring Samson daily until his soul was vexed. It's just a wonderful example of a selfish demand. Of course, in Delilah's case, this is really extreme because she's trying to find out the secret of his strength so she can get paid by her fellow Philistines, knowing that they're going to kill her husband. What I don't understand is why in the world, after it became obvious after the first time when he told her a fake story and then she does it to him at night in his sleep, I mean, that should have been the end. But he continues to go along with it. He'd become so weak, he just couldn't tell her no. It's really pitiful. But it's a selfish demand. Let nothing be done through selfish ambition. Let each of you look out for not only your own interest, but also for the interest of others. This is talking about brethren. But certainly that's true in a marriage. And before you make a major decision, ask how the other party would feel before moving forward. I heard of a gospel preacher who got a really good offer from a congregation to move somewhere else with better weather and better salary, and he just immediately accepted the offer and ran down and announced to his wife that they were moving without consulting her or asking how this would impact her and the children. I mean, that was really unkind and selfish. And shouldn't have done that. I got this offer, let's talk about it. You're a team here. So don't make selfish demands. And then very importantly is dishonesty. This perhaps is one of the most important love busters, because a marriage is based on trust, and catching your spouse in a lie breaks down trust in a very significant matter. I mean, who wants to live with a liar? And the problem is, once you catch your spouse in a lie, you start to wonder, well, what else is this person telling me that's not true? And so you got a question mark over your head now about everything. So even if it's going to get you in trouble to admit something you did that you shouldn't have done, it's better to be honest about it than to cover it up. And then when you're found out later, it is like 10 times worse. Always be honest, even when it hurts. Harley says, the key is to reveal to your spouse your thoughts, your feelings, your habits, your likes, your dislikes, your personal history, your daily activities, and plans for the future. Things that impact the other party. Let them know. And the worst kind of dishonesty in some ways to me is honesty, which is a form of deception by not sharing things that the other party really had the right to know. Many years ago, I know of a couple that got married, and on their honeymoon, the husband revealed, by the way, I don't want any children. We're not having kids. And the wife had assumed that they would have children. That usually kind of goes along with being married. But he had avoided the subject, and she goes, well, you should have told me. And he goes, well, listen, I did not lie to you. I never told you that we would have children. I'm not backpedaling. We just never discussed this. She goes, well, yeah, I guess we should have discussed it sooner. Well, why didn't you tell me? This is important to me and to us. He said, well, I was afraid you wouldn't marry me. So after he gets married on his honeymoon, he hits her with this. They had a terrible honeymoon. And later on, that marriage ended in divorce, in part because it started off with this major deception of silence about something that they should have discussed. So think about that. You want to make sure that you are honest. Jacob deceived Isaac in the darkness of his blindness. And it caused a huge rift between Jacob and his brother Esau that took over 20 years to resolve. And then kind of what goes around comes around. Later on, Jacob is deceived in the darkness of the wedding tent and winds up, you know, getting Leah instead of Rachel. And so what goes around comes around. Dishonesty throughout the Bible is one of those things that causes difficulty, and for good reason. The Bible says, therefore, putting away all lying, each one speak truth to one another. Apparently, this was the trouble among early Christians. Twice the Bible says, do not lie to one another, implied that there was a problem with that. And in Proverbs 12:22, lying is an abomination to Jehovah, but those who deal truthfully are his delight. That was one of my children's early memory verses. I believe in parenting through the Proverbs, these little pithy statements that are easy to recall that have powerful impact. And so one of the reasons why couples have difficulties is when they're not honest with one another. And then finally, there's independent behavior. This is the conduct of one spouse that is conceived and executed as if the other spouse does not even exist. That preacher who came down and just announced they were moving, it's a good example of independent behavior as well as a selfish demand. Now, I'm not talking about unhealthy dependency, kind of a codependent relationship. But I am talking about, you know, making decisions that impact the spouse without considering their feelings. Interdependent behavior is what you're looking for, where the partners nurture and protect each other. You know, if you're going to go on vacation and, you're a man and you're going to make all the decisions and you're going to go camping, and the wife, her idea of roughing it is a black and white and a Holiday Inn, which is what my mom used to say. You know, if that's not a vacation for her, that's something she dreads. Well, that's not very thoughtful. It's independent behavior. This is a family vacation. Get input from everybody involved so you can have a vacation that everybody enjoys, or at least something that you trade off so everybody's needs and wants are considered. That's the opposite of this cooperative partnership that we want to have. Mark 10:8-9. So they are no longer two, but one. Therefore, what God hath joined together, let not man separate. So again, you're working together, hopefully, as a unit. And it really hurts the spouse's feelings when their perspective is not considered. So those are the love busters. There's six of them. And those are things you need to avoid at all cost. And if a couple's having trouble, those are what you need to identify and then be determined to stop. So you'll notice in your special handout that I've got a place there where the love busters are mentioned, and I asked each spouse to rate the other party's love busters on a scale of 1 to 5. And it's really interesting, the conversations that you have with a couple when you see what your spouse thinks about these love busters. And is this a problem? And if it is, then the party needs to immediately acknowledge the offense, recognize the hurt, and do their best to develop new habits that avoid hurting their spouse. And so I hope you'll take this home and you'll go through this and talk about it. Because when you have love busters that are unaddressed, romantic love is always the victim. And love deposits, as I said, will not be received because there's a wall up. And also, beware, a few major withdrawals can undo scores of prior deposits. And so if you lose it and call your spouse a really hurtful name, you know, it may take 20 positive deposits to make up for that one major withdrawal. So think before you speak, because you can say something that's going to take a long time for the spouse to overcome. Here are six steps to overcome. First of all, be committed and yet have patience, because it takes time. I mean, I mentioned that getting around the habit of dog-earing pages on a book, I kept on forgetting, and I needed patience, but I was working on it till finally I no longer do that. So be committed and yet have patience, and only do one at a time. It's a mistake to find that you've got, you know, a bunch of these love busters that come up. Figure out what's the most annoying or the most difficult, and work on one at a time until that's solved, and then work on the next. That's what I do, as kind of a coach helping a couple through this. And try to identify the why. Are there some triggers here that need to be identified that perhaps could avoid maybe the angry outburst or whatever it is? You know, what is it that makes you so angry about this? Maybe you need to get down to the source and talk about that. Identify the why and avoid these triggers. And develop alternative behaviors. I call them righteous substitutes. Maybe somebody tends to go like this and always kind of do that with their fingers and just drives the wife crazy. Well, maybe you can get a stress ball. It's silent. And instead of drumming your fingers like that, you just do this stress ball. Everybody's happy, right? There are a lot of examples of things you can do that might be alternative behaviors. If you're angry and you're in an argument, and you know that's often when things are said that are not healthy and appropriate, give each other a timeout sign. Just agree, okay? Let's take a timeout. I need to cool off. And go and say a prayer. Go out and go for a walk. Come back 30 minutes, hour later maybe, and continue the discussion. Calm down. I care about you too much to say something I might regret, so let me have a cooling off period. See, that's a righteous substitute. And as your mate, ask for evaluation weekly. This is especially for a couple who's having difficulties. How do you think I'm doing? Did you not realize that you, that magazine over there, you dog-eared the page? No, I didn't know. Did I really? Yes, I did. I'm so sorry. See, get evaluation, because your spouse may notice things that you don't. And of course, pray both privately and together about what you're working through to basically develop compatibility, which is what this is all about. What's the key? Both must communicate clearly what they find is a withdrawal. Don't just bury these things. That's how you have bitterness toward the other party. So let them feel like you're not going to, you know, get in a big argument or be angry or say, well, what about you? You do this, this, or that. Well, right now we're talking about you, not the other person. See, communicate clearly without being defensive. And there's a form in the material where you can, you know, rate your mate on these areas and listen to what the other party has to say. And then ask God to help you to develop new habits so that you can be irresistible to your spouse. Both must learn to care and protect each other in practical ways. You know, I like early church history. And one of the things that amazes me about some of the quotes that the critics of the Christians would say is they would criticize the early Christians for not participating in their Colosseum activities, which was filled with violence, and not participating in their theaters, which were usually X-rated. And, you know, they kind of withdrew from a lot of pagan society because it had to do with a lot of immorality. And the pagans resented that, like, you think you're better than us and that kind of thing. So they'd be railing against the Christians, but then they'd often say, oh, but what loving and close marriages and families they have. And so their worst critics still had to admit that they had really good marriages and families. And so my question is, can that be said of us today? Are there people out there who say, you know, I don't agree with your understanding of baptism and that it's for the remission of sins, and there's other things that you guys practice that, you know, I just don't agree with, but boy, you guys really have happy marriages and well-behaved, respectful children. It's really a shame to me that the Mormons, who have just a lot of bizarre doctrines, just to be respectful as I can, but they're known for their close marriages and families. And one of the reasons why people often seek out Mormonism is they're looking for answers and they want a closer, more meaningful family relationship. So they seek out the Mormons because they're known for that. And I just kind of cringe. I think we're not known for that, and we should be. And so I want to do my part in trying to not just focus on MDR, marriage, divorce, and remarriage. I mean, those are important doctrinal decisions, but I want to focus on prevention. Let's focus on the marriage. What can we do to help nurture really successful and happily married people and really close-knit families? And that would just be my prayer, that even people who disagree with us doctrinally will just have to admit that this is the place where most of the people are really together when it comes to their families. And I believe these simple principles can make all the difference, because it's just practical ways to communicate what is needed so that people have love banks that are full and overflowing. Does that make sense? Okay, we got about 5 minutes till our break. Anybody got any thoughts or questions or feedback?
I have a question.
Yes, sir.
At this point in your marriage, have you found that if you want to finish a book, you have to do it one sitting?
No, I haven't, because I use bookmarks. And it's a new habit. And, you know, it's better for me to develop a new habit that coincided with my wife's preferences than it is to have that be a constant irritant. Does that make sense? Okay.
I have a question.
Yes, go ahead.
How is the love bucket different from keeping score?
You know, that's a good point. You know, the Bible does basically say that love taketh no account of evil. And we shouldn't hold resentment in our hearts. And then when we get into an argument, it's like, and another thing, and another thing, and another thing. And we've held all these things in, and we let them have it with 8 or 9 things at once. That's not good. You deal with one thing at a time. So I would never advise someone to, you know, like, keep a list of all the things that bug you about your spouse and then dwell on those things. That's not healthy, and that can lead to bitterness. But if your spouse is bugging you or hurting your feelings, the loving thing to do is to mention that in a loving way and say, I'd really appreciate it if you'd stop doing it. It really mean a lot to me. See, that's the spirit of cooperative enterprise versus I'm going to keep a list of these events so I can use them later against you or something. So I think that's the difference. Yes?
Turn it around. It's the, why wouldn't you want to know what's bugging your spouse?
Yes.
It's more than they're keeping score, it's more like, I want to know. If
yes.
If I'm doing something that's bothering you, I want to know it.
Yeah, yeah. You know, to go back to the idea of honesty, I tease my wife. She's pretty good at reality checks where, you know, she gives me feedback on my ministry and on my sermons, and most of the time she's very affirming, but sometimes she'll say, I don't think that was one of your best. And I'll say, okay, what do you think I could have done to improve that? And so she helps me. And if I've done something that she thinks was maybe not that considerate or something that maybe was inappropriate, she'll tell me about it in a nice way. And what we do is we have this rule that we don't criticize the other party without first asking permission. So, I have a suggestion for you about your parenting. Is this a good time, or can we talk about it later? So she gives me the respect of knowing something's coming and thinking about it, and then I can never say, we can talk about it now, or maybe, you know, this is not a good time. Let's talk about it later. But I always know there's transparency there and that we're being real with one another. And so when she does say, that was a really good lesson, I really appreciated it, she's not just being polite. I know it's for real because at other times she doesn't say that. And so you want that kind of honesty. When it comes to her cooking, she's a very good cook. And she knows that if I don't say anything, she'll say, you didn't comment on the meal today. I'll say, well, that was not my favorite. She goes, okay, I won't make that again. It's really more about my taste buds than her cooking because she's a great cook. But, you know, I know of a true story where a guy was trying to be polite, and he, from the very time they were early married, his wife had this favorite dish she liked to make, and so he just sort of ate the food and kind of smiled, and what do you think? Oh, this is so delicious. And so guess what? The wife kept on making it for him. And after about several years of him stomaching this dish he couldn't stand, he finally said, please don't make this anymore. I can't stand this. And she was so hurt. You've been telling me for years you love that. I remember we were just married a week, and I asked you about it. And he goes, I wasn't telling the truth. I didn't want to hurt your feelings. He did a lot more harm by being dishonest. Right? So I want you to be so honest that you're tactful. You don't say, this tastes terrible, but you might say, this isn't my favorite. So you get proper feedback to each other so you can respond to each other instead of not being real. Be honest and don't lie about, oh, that looks great, if it doesn't look great. I know that kind of goes against culture. But you shouldn't lie even if that's the polite thing to say. Figure out a way to be honest without being rude. And that will mean so much to you because that helps me to know that there aren't walls up between my wife and I. That's our biggest enemy because we're honest with each other. And that means a lot. And that's where you get the passion and the respect that you oftentimes lose if you're playing these kind of games. So yes, you ought to want to know. How can I please you better in this area? I want to know, even if sometimes it might, sting a little bit. I'd rather know early than to find out years later that I have been messing up. Okay, 10:51. Let's take a 9-minute break and we'll get ready for part 3. Thank you for your feedbacks, statements.
Thanks again for joining us today. If you have questions about anything you heard today or anything Bible-related, you can use the contact form on our website at teachingtruth.org to submit a question and someone will be in touch. There's also lots of other great Bible content on our site as well. The web address again is teachingtruth.org. Once again, thanks for listening and we hope to see you in person soon.